Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where frontline sales leaders teach you how to build and scale an outbound sales team. Welcome back to the Predictable Revenue Podcast. I'm your host, Colin Stewart. Today, I'm joined by Jeff Sterlin, but you might know him from his roles either at Marketo or Intercom, running sales ops. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Colin. Good to be here.
So I understand you've got an interesting place in history being Marketo's one of their early customers. Talk to me about that.
I was top 50. They tell me I was 49, but I think I might've been a bit earlier. Yes.
Nice. And we'll talk about it a little bit later, but you ended up actually working at Marketo. Do you want to maybe tell me about that transition?
Yeah, it was, I was working at a company. It was, called Golden Gate Software at the time, sold very technical stuff. But we were really trying to scale our marketing and we were looking to do lead scoring, and Marketo had just came along. They came in, we did like a conference room pilot for a day. It connected everything perfectly to Salesforce. We actually ran our first little mini campaign with them that day and we were hooked. And it was really key to us growing and scaling there. We got acquired by Oracle about a year later. One of the persons in marketing who was kind of managing the Marketo system ended up moving over to Marketo, and she was probably employee 30 or something, and did a great job there. So met folks, stayed in touch with her, followed the growth. Went to work at another company after that acquisition with the head of sales, who became the CEO. The first thing we did was buy Marketo. So we kind of took our playbook, which was successful, and became, I think at that point, customer 600 and something, which shows how fast they grew in about 3 years. That company about 2 years later got acquired by IBM. I hung out there for a while and I had built some relationships at Marketo, and I was kind of branching out and seeing what was available, talking to folks. I reached out to some folks there, and Bill Bench, who you probably know, said, "Hey, I think we have a role like this that we need to build here as we're going through our next stage of growth. You want to come in and talk about it?" And we did. And I met a whole bunch of other people, and you know, kind of perfect timing that we were acquired at that point, and I was looking to leave again. And it was a chance to really work with a company that I saw from that kind of, you know, first 50 customers and knew the value that it delivered firsthand because we used it at two places, to really go in there and to see the inner workings of how they got to where they were and help to get them to where they were going after that. So all the stars aligned, which typically does not happen. Great company, great product, working with some great friends, some great leaders, and it was just an awesome ride up to then. But also after Marketo, I think every company that I've been at, I've learned a lot of good stuff.
That's awesome. It's such a cool experience to have somebody on the show that's sort of worked with a number of the people we've either had on the show or I've interviewed. Because I've had plenty of time to sit down with Bill, and I learned a ton in the short period of time. Yeah. That we did have together. And then we've also had John Miller, not on the show, but we actually interviewed him for the next version of Aaron's book that's coming out in a couple months. And so I got a chance I got a couple hours with John, and that was a really special time.
Yeah, no, it was, I learned a ton from Bill before I worked there, and even John in the early days, and they kind of became, especially Bill, someone who I relied on to ask those career questions and what do you think about this company and how do you do this? Can you introduce me to that person? So it was really great to work directly with him on the day-to-day and really see his style, the way he does things, his points of view, his philosophies, how he handles both the good and the tough situations that come up. And it was just a great partnership that we had. And we, stayed in touch ever since and hope one day that we can pull back together and kind of do this again somewhere. It was a fantastic, 3-4 years of collaborating with Bill and John.
That's really cool. And yeah. I mean, that's sort of the focus of the episode today, is just on the sort of the glue that holds everything together, the methodology, the process that sort of ties that together. So I wonder if you could talk to me just a little bit about sort of, cause you were at Marketo, which scaled pretty quickly, and now your Intercom, which is also scaling, I imagine, pretty quickly. So can you talk to me about like what sort of changed from the time when, you were scaling Marketo versus now that you're at Intercom?
Yeah, I think depending on which way you go on what's changed, I mean, certainly I think the one thing that you can never replace is just having gone through this at a number of places, both the times when you've been successful and the times when you haven't, of understanding the things that are involved and really helping to scale. It's part removing yourself from where the company's been and really looking forward and quite frankly, breaking some things. Including possibly some dogma or ways that organizations might have organically evolved to really put the things in to allow the company to scale. There's certainly a lot of process analysis, redesign, workflow that you've got to think about how it works across global offices, people that have been there for years, people that you're hiring, sales teams doubling, more complexity in the products you're selling to and the markets you're selling to, et cetera. You've then got to think about how you implement this in the systems. The one biggest thing that I think I have learned in the last, you know, I don't know how many years, I don't even want to say it, of doing these things, is that without the buy-in from the team, and I don't just say executives, but, you know, the field as well, you know, the ICs, the reps, the people doing the job on a daily basis, it doesn't work. And I think if it doesn't start with the why you're doing this, if it doesn't start with bringing people in so you can bring them along, if it doesn't start with collaborating and understanding what their needs are, what's not working well, if it doesn't involve some collaboration with them when you are going through design, and I don't mean approvals or buy-offs or yes or no's, but including the people whose problems you're fixing, whose challenges you're addressing, whose lives you're making better, who you're helping to scale, no matter what methodology you use on the other side, no matter what you're deploying, I think is been my experience, the difference between getting these things right and having false starts and maybe not ever achieving success in what you're trying to do.
Interesting. I've done a lot of I don't think I would call myself a sales ops person, but I've certainly done a lot of things that you might call that might have been jobs that would fall on the sales ops person, just sort of being usually an early hire, fairly nerdy on the sales side. So I've always been fairly good with technology, but not to the point of actually being an engineer. I feel like I've done some of these things on a small scale, and I feel like probably a lot of listeners have probably had a similar experience. But I think there's a difference between sort of having configured Salesforce for a small team of a few people versus setting up a methodology or a system for hundreds of people across a global organization.
Right.
Can you talk to me about what it's like to operate at that scale?
Yeah, I certainly will. When I first started, I was not in sales ops. I was doing biz dev and solution consulting. We had purchased Salesforce, and this was in the early to mid 2000s. I taught myself how to configure it like so many of us. And I think by doing it, those of us that had that, I don't know, operational gene or the desire to kind of do these things, we kind of self-teach us the skills that we need, both with some of the systems and tools. But by doing that, we're also kind of teaching ourselves the workflows and methodologies because we kind of have to. So I think whether you end up going into ops or you end up being a consultant and a trainer, or you end up being a sales manager, having that kind of operational bent and having to do this maybe at a small company, I think serves you well in many different roles and jobs. I think the difference was probably like you back then when they were smaller teams and it wasn't as complex. I just kind of did it all and did it how I felt and thought it needed to be done. You know, over time I hired an administrator who would help with all the day-to-day stuff. But, you know, I wanted to change some fields or put in some validation rules or kind of force the capture of information as we're flowing through our methodology. I would just do it. To be quite honest with you, back at Marketo and even at Intercom, I look at how these things are now built and all of the connections and integrations and third-party solutions and add-ons that are being used. It's way past my skill set anymore. I can change an owner, I can maybe move some fields around, but it's really become such an important piece of infrastructure when you look at that whole go-to-market stack that you absolutely need to hire experts. So I have built up really a team of one or two to three almost full-time Salesforce go-to-market engineers that can do everything to change the UI, to clean up all the validation rules, to custom build all of these great ideas that pop into my head that I'm not sure how 3 days later I see in there. I have folks on the team now that have back-end skills, so they can connect it to our big database. They can connect it better to Marketo or Intercom or any of these other tools that we want to use to create that seamless end-to-end flow that allows, I think, for really scalable, efficient execution with all of the tools that we use now. And then I also have folks who are function very much like product managers. They're product owners of our Salesforce instance, and they view it that way. They build roadmaps. We have an intake process to understand what's going on. We do a little bit of what we call here an intermission, intercom intermissions, but they're kind of like BDRs or business required documents or technical requirement documents, where we kind of take the ideas and the suggestions and we blast it out to understand, you know, the outcomes and the goals and the use cases, the current situation, the desired state, the milestones, the effort, and the impact. So in many ways, we manage and we have been managing, you know, our Salesforce instance, but our whole tech stack as if it's a product, with product owners, product managers, you know, technical and business, you know, solution folks. There's some architecture that goes on, and then certainly building the engineering skills along with the hardcore configuration skills to be able to constantly not only put new things in there, but to maintain and do all those little things that happen on a, you know, monthly, weekly, daily basis. So, and it's, you know, a team of six or seven folks.
Wow. That's a really cool team. And I'm sure, like, it doesn't sound, I don't think there are many others in a situation sort of supporting such a large organization mm-hmm. like that. I'd love to know how do you approach a new team? So maybe when you just started at Intercom, how do you, you've built mm-hmm. out a big team now, and it sounds like you've got some great processes. You've got some great teams sort of supporting, like, underneath you that are building things out and sort of handling mm-hmm. things. How do you figure out where to start?
That is a great question, and it's a very difficult one. I think I can go back to Marketo. You know, when I first started there, Marketo was a lot of transactions, high volume, a lot of additional upsells and renewals that you had to do at your customer base. The deal desk function, the quote to cash function, was incredibly important. We had a little bit of reporting, and it worked well. Enablement, I had a little bit of, but we decided to hire a very senior person to kind of build that function out. So where to start was really quote to cash. And I found that out by talking to Bill. I found that out by talking to other folks when I joined. I found that out by talking to our CFO, to our CIO, you know, to sales directors of the real pain point that it was becoming was the systems weren't set up in a way that made it easy to manage all of the transactions. Quote, do them quickly, do them efficiently, do them with a really good customer and customer experience, get them closed, get them provisioned, make sure we were recognizing the revenue. So probably the first 18 months there was really building out and scaling that function, building out a renewals operations team, implementing CPQ, those sort of things. So I would say that the way that I honed in on that was really just by coming in and asking and hearing where all the challenges and issues were. After that, you know, we started building out some other functions, a little more, not necessarily data analytics, but folks that can step a little bit further back and use data, do some analysis, make recommendations on how to improve the overall performance of the org, or even think about creating and going after new things. Conversely, here at Intercom, we're very, very, very high volume, but a lot of our customers, in fact, the vast majority are month to month. There's no contracts. So the concept of quote to cash isn't as big here. So what was big here? It was managing, because we own both our self-serve and our sales-led business, and we're very much trying to enable an account management, relationship management team. So here it became very much more attached to some of these more strategic programs that we were putting in place, building a really great functioning outbound SDR team, almost from scratch, building out how we want to deploy account execs and relationship managers to our install base, how we want to segment that, the types of processes and methodologies and measures and performance that we want to drive. So here it was a little bit more of very specific strategies, org changes, things that we wanted to really build and get out globally of focusing on those. So much more project-based, I would say here. But there was also a lot of stuff here that I would put under cleanup, kind of getting some standardization on how we do comp planning and deploy comp plans, starting to deploy some policy around that, honing in on our forecast processes and methodologies, which, because we're a month-to-month business and high volume, we probably don't have Well, we do have a need to do them, but we probably neglected the need to do them as much as others. So I'm doing what we call pipeline refresh and relaunching some forecasting tools and methodologies. So I would call that kind of cleanup. But now, because we are selling larger deals to bigger companies and signing a lot of agreements, quote to cash is, you know, popping up again. So, you know, it's kind of always circular, and I can rely on the experience that I had and the people that I worked with before. In fact, you know, I've interacted with many folks still at Marketo to get some sense about how that's evolved over time and to introduce me to some folks to understand best practices and then connecting my team. So in many ways, I think where do I start has to be, at the end of the day, we're a service organization. We have to make sure the team can efficiently and scalably get to its goals and objectives. So I want to go have them guide me to what's needed. And it's not just sales. It can also be, you know, the executive team as a whole. It could be our partners in marketing or, you know, our CFO or other things that might be more cross-functional, broader initiatives. But I think that that direction really needs to come from our stakeholders and hit the right sort of things. And then we've got to tell them the plan of how we're going to do that.
That's really interesting. It's almost like you're another little services organization or building a product that's sort of maintaining a product, but almost a separate company that's there that just exists to support the parent company.
In a sense, I do think that our mission is to, and I think we talked about this earlier, if I were just to describe to somebody, is to make stuff better. Mm-hmm. So what isn't working today? What it hasn't been working for a while, what needs to work in a year from now based on our overall company direction, that we need to evolve, stand up from scratch, rethink, re-implement, re-engineer, just get right. Ultimately, I think that's what we do. I don't necessarily want to say we're separate. I very much love being part of the sales team, and I very much love hiring people who want to be part of the sales team. You know, we were at our sales kickoff and we were celebrating our wins and we were getting awards, and we have a thing up on the Hoopla board that talks about the things that we're delivering to and those sort of things. So we're very much part of the sales team, but we are very much in that support, if you will, role of making sure that as much time as is humanly possible, our reps and our managers are focusing on our prospects and our customers and not how to do this or how to do that, or any of those inefficiencies that drive it, while maintaining the appropriate amount of control and governance so that we can, you know, manage the company as a whole. But yes, we are a service organization with stakeholders who should, at the end of the day, be helping us and guiding us onto what those most critical things are that we would deploy our capacity against to, you know, to assist with and to work on.
That's really awesome. And I think it's one of the reasons why I was so excited to have you on the show, because this is sort of, you know, I found when a lot of teams first hire their first sales ops person, it's just, there's this huge backlog of like, oh, we haven't been doing this because we didn't have somebody and we need to do this. There's a lot of catch up. There's a lot of cleanup. Right. And I think it's so easy to get caught in firefighting mode. And so you've been through this, you've been through cycles, and you've not just like been through cycles, but you've been through cycles at scale. So I'd love if you could share, like, I'd love to learn your process and how you think about sort of when you come in. So beyond just the sort of cleanup, how do you sort of organize and like, what are the steps involved?
Great question. I think that, you know, one of the fun parts I think of being in sales is, you know, constantly ringing the bell. I like the action, you know, but that does bring up fires. And I think if you step back, whenever a rep or a manager runs into a problem, they can't figure out how to do something, something's not working right, something's making their life difficult, it's a fire. And in their world, that is the single most important thing that we should work on right now. Stop everything else that we're doing and fix that problem. And they're not necessarily wrong. But if you get into that sort of mode, we're not going to be fixing the problem. We're just going to be addressing some symptoms. We're going to be sticking our fingers, you know, to plug the dam. But there's still going to be holes in this. So the idea, you know, of where you're going is that we need to be able to pull back and take a look a little more broadly in aggregate, holistically and longer term of what are those true problems that we need to be solved. And that's a product development framework and methodology we use here at Intercom, which we've adopted as well. Why are those holes there? What do we need to do, whether it's in a foundation, whether it's re-implementation of the system, whether it's better training and documentation to make sure that they're permanently closed. So a couple of things that we've been doing here, and I have been for many reasons fighting a lot of fires since we've joined, but we've kind of got out of making sure that they're kind of, you know, not burning anymore. Maybe they're still smoldering. But we, for the last 3 months, have went through a pretty intense road mapping process. It started with intake that you do with a product, you know, management team. We went and we met with our stakeholders. We did a bunch of round bags and round tables. We provided mechanisms for people to just jot down all of the things that they wish we can do and fix it. It was interesting as we went through that process of oftentimes people tell you the solution, you know, just go do this and buy this piece of software and change this around. And we really tried to work with everybody as patiently as we can of what's the problem we're really trying to solve. Not the solution, but what is that problem? And then we'll come back with that multiple solutions. And you find that when you kind of take that approach of what's the problem? What do you want to achieve? It's taking too long to route leads is different than saying buy this solution and have these rules, right? So let's go dissect why it's taking too long to route leads and what the right amount of time it is to route leads and whether that works for us or not works for us and what value we can get if we do them faster. So we went through that for a couple of months. We built our roadmap, and these are things that are outside of the day-to-day. We still have to deploy a ton of our capacity to keep the lights on, to keep the trains running on time, to do all those things that do come up. But say we have 40% of our capacity left over, is we took these items from intake, we put them on the roadmap, we did a little investigation as to what we really think they are, and just a little big sizing. Is it small effort or extra large effort? What's the impact? Is it small impact or large effort to kind of help us prioritize them? Then we went back with our stakeholders and we said, this is the list of what we think we can, given the time, the capacity, the ability to deploy these things and deliver the outcomes, can do in this quarter. And we got down to a list of 32, and we did some horse trading, but we made sure we socialized it with everybody. And I actually rolled that out at our sales kickoff last week. I probably bored a bunch of folks, but I went line by line of outside of, we're going to make sure the things are working the way they should on the day-to-day basis, that you're going to get paid, that leads are being routed and assigned, that reports are accurate, that we're helping get deals closed. These are the things and only these things that the rest of the team is going to work on, and we're committing to getting them done this quarter. So anything not on this list, you can ask us, it goes into intake, it will get on the roadmap for consideration later, but we're not going to jump to another fire in order to pull capacity off of this to do that, because we're actually going to complete these things. So in very many ways, it's kind of like a product development roadmap of what we went through in order to figure out what needs to be there, determine what priorities are needed, the capacity and the things that we need it to deliver them, and then the commitment to do it.
That's really awesome. And so I'm hearing like there's the intake, the sort of planning, and then commit cycle. And it's the fact that you've documented and formalized that helps sort of keep you out of firefighting mode.
I believe so. Now, this is the first quarter that we've done this for real, but I absolutely believe it will. I think that once, you know, the 300 plus people between sales and support here that are the beneficiaries of this, when you show them the breadth of what you're working on and the commitments you're making, they're not wondering what you're doing, or they're not wondering why this and not that, because we're able to explain why this became the priority and this maybe did become the priority, or why there's blockers or constraints for us not being able to do this now. I do think that it does serve in many ways to set those expectations of this is what we're working on, and then people get that and they understand it and they don't come with the fires. They still come with the requests, and we give them a mechanism to submit those requests, but they know that if I create a fire, they're going to have to not do one of these things. And these things are just as important as this thing that just happened to me today or yesterday that I'm bringing up and raising up. So I do hope, and I'm very hopeful that it will bring that sort of alignment around with our stakeholders and with what we're doing, as these are the things that we're working on. And we don't want to get distracted from them, because the worst thing I think that ops teams do when they fight fires is you never quite finish some of these bigger things. Right. And then that's no good for anybody. And I think once we start delivering many of these, people will feel good and comfortable that I have a say. I know that there's a formal process and a lot of collaboration and communication of how we set the roadmap and the priorities. And I know that they're going to get done. So I know things are going to get done in the future. So I'm hopeful that it's going to take, and I'm very excited to prove that out here at Intercom this quarter and as we start doing this for next quarter.
That's really exciting. I know I've been on both sides of this, both as a salesperson, as a sales ops person, even as a, in a product management role, going to the dev team with like, hey, here's this new fire or this new idea or this new thing. And the worst thing that you can do is give a person like me unlimited access to a dev team that's that has to say yes, because you're just going to end up building the world's shittiest CRM system, which so we did. So kind of learned my lesson a little bit that way. And you know, it's the natural tendency of the sort of recency bias. Hey, this just happened to me. Therefore, it's the most important thing. And having a process for intake, for planning, for committing sort of reminds everybody of like, okay, well, here are the priorities, right? Is what is on fire for you right now, is that more important than any of these things? No? Okay, well, great. Then let's drop an intake and we'll look at it next cycle or next quarter.
You're absolutely correct. When people come with those fires because something just happened, I get it. You know, it's impactful. It's causing stress. Things aren't getting done the way you want them to get done. But I think an intake, no matter what you want to call it or how you do it, allows people to step back and kind of get out of that moment when they're filled with like, this just sucks. I need it to get fixed. It needs to happen now. And we're designing our intake now, and it's going to have, some friction, some questions. We're going to ask them, to really describe what that problem is. We're going to ask them to describe how it's done now. We're going to ask them a little bit of, how do you think it should be done? We're going to ask them a little bit of like, what real benefit do you think that you are going to get out of this? And how many people do you think are going to get out of this? They're going to have to think. It's not going to take more than 10 minutes. They're going to have to collect their thoughts a little bit and really think about what they're asking or what that problem was, which I think ultimately provides us with better insights to actually fix what's going on.
That's great.
Yes. And we're not saying no when people come. We're just simply saying, let's just follow this process that we all know leads to a good roadmap, right? So they still have an output of which to get them in.
Leave it to the sales ops guy from Intercom to come up with this process. Like, is Dez sitting in there with you?
He's not. I don't think he is. Look, I can't claim that I came up with this alone. I truly think ops is a team sport. The folks that work for me, our partners, our stakeholders, my colleagues, a lot of this is kind of very collaborative. What do you think? And how does this sound? And how does that work? So I think collectively we adopted many things that Intercom does and we apply them to this, specific function, which is great.
That's awesome. I love the high level sort of intake. And then like that process. So I'd love if you could talk to me about maybe if we just dove into that, because the planning, the commit cycle, that's great. But if we dove into like you mentioned, you had sort of six steps for road mapping. So once you've decided, hey, this is something we want to dive in on, like, and you sort of alluded to the first step is interviewing and sort of shadowing the team. So problem first, but so talk to me about that process. So like what happens next? So you interview, you shadow people, then what?
Yeah, I think the structure that we just put with this, we're going to start from about start of quarter minus 5 weeks. So the fifth and the fourth week out from the start of the next quarter, so basically the end of the second month, we're going to start doing our kind of broader intakes in which we want to meet with people face to face. And I'm heading out to Dublin to meet with the team there in 3 weeks. And then the week after, we'll do it here in North America. And I think that meeting face-to-face in a structured way with teams, like I want to meet with the SDRs independent of AEs, independent of our relationship managers, and I'm going to meet with managers separately. And when they know this is coming, and I did this for the last one too, is they actually come prepared. Like some of them brought me some presentations and Word documents where they all put in their ideas. And I didn't ask them to do that. And it was spectacular that we gave them a formal outlet of our time. And I brought a couple of folks from my team out here. And then my whole team that's out there joined these. And it really, truly was, and we kind of coined that phrase here too, a little bit of a listening tour, is we're not going to come with solutions. We're not going to tell you where we think this fits in the priorities. We're not going to say this can and can't be done. We're just going to simply listen to the things that are going on in your world. And we did that. And I think those one build bridges. I think that builds empathy. I think that really allows them to have that outlet and to articulate without an expectation that it's going to be done tomorrow. the things that are being done. And I think it also provides them an opportunity to prepare, and some of them prepared as a team before they met us, for them to actually figure out, if we can tell them five things, what are those five things? So it wasn't just like a random, you know, shot of like a million things just coming from anybody and everybody. It was a thoughtful kind of intake, which I didn't, again, necessarily expect, but it actually just kind of happened, which I think proves the first point of, you know, comms and stakeholder management and face-to-face interaction leads to, I think, really good outcomes. So we do that with all of the teams. We then pull together within ops all the things that we've heard, and we make sure they're on there. There might be some that, quite frankly, we might never do. But everybody that had something that was there, I want them to at least see it on there so they know that it was taken seriously. And we just build up, you know, little short one-liners for each of them. That week after that, so the third week before the start of the new quarter, is we start pulling up again with the global managers and our sales leadership team and our support leadership team. Here's what we've heard. They sit in there as well. Here's the consolidation of all the things we heard. And many of the things might be consistent across many teams or geographies. And here's our first point of view of what we think would make a fairly good roadmap for the next quarter. And that roadmap should be comprehensive. It should not just focus on things that only the AEs want. We want something in there that hopefully everybody gets a little bit of benefit, or a single thing where the whole global team gets some benefit. And then we also have to construct it against our capacity. It can't be 100% enablement. It can't be 100% systems. I have to balance the capacity and the other things that the teams are working on as well. So I think we provide a really good first draft of like, here's what we think in ops from what we heard. Here's what we think we can actually execute given our capacity. What do you guys think? They then go through that process of understanding them, of asking questions, of vetting them, of going back to their teams. Like, if is this really the thing that we want done, or is this thing down there as a P2? Who do we want to switch them? But it gets us into that good mode of, for lack of a better word, horse trading. You know, if they want something else pulled up, you know, I'm going to ask them, which is the one you want to be pulled down, right? We even had a great discussion of, are we better off doing 40 little things or three really big things, right? And I think those are the exact type of discussions we need to have. So we spend the third week doing that. We take the second week out with Justin Ops from what we heard from that week before. And we kind of validate it to another layer. Okay, these are the things that it seems like people want us to do. Are we sure that it's only going to take this many resources in this many weeks? Are we sure we've identified all of the things that we might need in order to fully enable this? Additional resources, help from partners, some pre-work or other things that might need to get done before we can actually do this? And do we feel comfortable as an ops team that we can commit to doing these, or commit to doing the vast majority of them? After we do that, we kind of make another couple of revisions. And then that week before the quarter ends is when we want to go through and get approval from sales and support leadership on this is the roadmap. And once we do that, we will take the next 2 or 3 weeks at the beginning of the quarter to roll it out to everybody globally. And we have given access to that big document view access to almost everybody. So we're trying to be as transparent as we can of, here's the things that are on there. Here's where they're being prioritized. Here's the time period of which we think we might get them done. Here's a couple of notes why we think they might be very impactful or not impactful, or why we think we can and can't get them done. So I don't think there's any, you know, magic there. I just think, you know, it sounds like 5 weeks, that's a long time. But I think if we didn't do it and at least give every single one of these hundreds of people that are doing the jobs on, you know, the daily, weekly, hourly basis, a chance to join us face to face and have other mechanisms to get their voice heard and know that it's being heard, that we would not have a lot of success with people necessarily socializing to it or accepting it or being okay that I understand why my thing's a P1 as opposed to P0. So I think that that alignment, that stakeholder management, that communications is the most important part of that at the end of the day.
Well, that sounds like it's quite the process. And I don't think I've seen it applied quite this way to sales ops before. So that was cool. If I can, let me try and parrot it back to you, because I was trying to take some notes. So basically, first step is you're meeting with all the stakeholders, right? You want to identify all the pains of all the teams that you're supporting, and then sort of try and quantify them. And maybe we can go after this, we can go into sort of the way that you sort of would design, you know, one of those solutions. Yeah. But so you're meeting with everybody. then you sort of articulate and you document everything and articulate, okay, here's what we think this, here's what we think the problem is, here's how we think we can solve it, or here's sort of high level of how we might be able to solve it. You sync up with management to consolidate the problem, or you consolidate the problems, sync up with management and work on sort of prioritizing. Here's all the things that we would like to be able to do. And then the next step is, so when you're working with management, it's like, okay, let's stack rank these things. And if you could only get, you know, these things, you're doing your horse trading, right? We think this is a big thing. I think these are a bunch of little things, and sort of trying to fit the sort of the rocks and sand in the cup, if you've seen that analogy. And then basically the next step is estimating the sort of time it's going to take for each one, figuring out what you can get done in the quarter, and then go into your executive leadership or your sales leadership to get sort of approval on that roadmap.
I think that's correct. And I'm actually trying to pull something up. I'm not intentionally looking away from you to get a little more detail, some things that the folks on my team are doing. But I think that the way you described it is correct. And depending on the size of your team, you can do this in 2 weeks, you know, if everyone's in the same office. Yeah. In our case, because we are globally distributed, kind of many different sort of businesses and segments team, it takes about 5 weeks. And because there's so many things here to do that we want to do, we want to be very thoughtful about that. I think that the key part of getting to the end of it when we get the approval for it is, even though it's an ops roadmap, I can almost sit back, and I have opinions, so I don't literally mean this, but I can almost sit back and say, hey, we've got this much capacity. We'll work on whatever you want us to work on. Right. And even though that's not necessarily the case, because we are going to come with our opinions and our recommendations, because we're in many ways closer to the solutions and have thought about how to solve these things. At the end of the day, if that's what the sales leadership and support leadership wants, we will work on the prioritized things in the order that they want it to work on. And I think going through this process of putting that in kind of their hands and their plate for that final, are you guys sure this is where you want us to deploy our resources, I think really gives them a sense of ownership. You know, they're not going to dictate our day to day or how we're going to organize ourselves or manage us through these processes and tasks, but they're very much setting what we're going to use that excess capacity out of, keeping the trains running on time and the lights on and those things that we just have to do, of how it's going to be used. And if it's not the right sort of priorities, they're as much accountable to that as we are, you know, at the end of the day. And I think that builds a great sort of partnership and shared ownership of all of this. And I think that's what allows us to stay on track with those things on the roadmap and then refresh it going into that next quarter. I think it's a very big part of that.
I think it's one of the best things that you're possibly doing for your team is sort of preventing the sort of senior management or anybody else from coming in and just saying, hey, we need this done right now. And you can say, listen, we've got this committed roadmap, because the number of sales organizations I've either been in or I've worked with or tried to help out, where, oh, we'll just pull somebody from sales ops in, you know, they're probably not that busy anyway. It's like having a dev at your whim that can just jump in and do anything at any time. And that's like having interruptions and little projects here and things like that. It just prevents you from getting any deep work done. Right. And I think that's the most frustrating thing.
It kills your ability to do it. And I think that when we started going into this process, which we started talking about last quarter, is I can name on a long list of things that we started on that were really important at the time that still are, but we were pulled off of to do other things and we actually never finished them. So what's the point? Like, you're actually not making progress. You're making a little bit of progress because there's the fire, we're all running towards it, and now maybe again it's out, but we're not really fixing anything. We all came to that same conclusion that we're better off allowing these things to get to the point of where they're truly fixed as opposed to constantly revisiting them. And I'm fortunate that I have, you know, a head of sales here and a bunch of folks in leadership here that are truly operational, but given whatever degree of operational they are, they understand the need for it and they respect it and they give us the space. And they give us the air cover, and they very much want it to work like this as well. This could not function at a place where people either don't get or appreciate the need to do those things, why operations are incredibly important, and the ultimate value that you can get by doing these things right. So having that first one makes that relatively easy. they get the fact that if they're constantly bringing these things up and pulling us from one thing to another, that the big things that their teams are complaining about and frustrated with and wish were better are never going to get addressed. But 100%, that's the whole idea of the intake of the roadmap and sticking with it. And we've got top-down air cover from, like, when we finalized it, this is it, guys, nothing else. And everyone was so totally on board. It was very fortunate to have colleagues in an organization that thinks like that.
That's great. Because I'm sure there were some salespeople or some people on the sales team that are like, well, nothing else unless something more important that I think comes up. And then I'm sure you still get people coming to you asking questions.
We do, but I think when they do, they know that it's not a discussion of this needs to go in. It's always a discussion of this goes in, something comes out. So it's not a binary or one directional sort of conversation. It's literally like, great, we can certainly do this, but look, here's the three things that are going on that have the resources that are going to need to implement this one. Mm-hmm. Which one do you want to stop working on? Your choice. You know, it very much puts that onus of prioritizing, truly prioritizing of, they're both really important. You can make the argument that everything on the roadmap's important, but this one just outweighs this one. So we're going to stick with what we had. Or the decision might go the other way, and that's perfectly okay too, because then they're not adding more to the plate, right? You know, the overall use of the capacity is the same. You mentioned something else that, you know, I think most folks on my team understand the need for this, but a big part of socializing it with them is exactly that. When they express the frustration with, oh, you know, another manager or person came over with this hard and they want me to stop everything that I'm working on and do this, and I think it's going to take 2 weeks of my time, that this gives them their cover too. It allows them to not have to say no. It allows them to refer back to the roadmap, right? It gives them the air cover and the space and the time to work on the things that we agreed on the roadmap to truly get them done without the anxiety or the fear or even the thought in the back of their mind that it can change at any one time just because something happens and, you know, someone's a loud voice to push it away. So I think it makes their world a ton easier too. In addition, we kind of ring the bell when we finish these things, right? You know, and it gives us a chance to very much go, boom, another one's marked off and Hoopla is going to go make some noise and have a walk-up song just like the reps do when they close it. So I think really gives them the satisfaction of completing a task and truly seeing the benefit and getting that recognition out on the floor as well. It has so many benefits for us internally to sales ops as it does for the people that we support.
That's great. That's so great. And just having that roadmap that you've committed to, that so your individual team members aren't feeling pressure from some manager, director coming sitting down and saying, "Hey, this needs to get done." It's like, yep, it can get done. Let's work through this process.
Yes.
In the sort of last time we chatted, we talked about a little bit about your sort of, you get that sort of 6-step process sort of once you've decided, hey, this is, or for kind of figuring out the, what you're going to build and how you're going to build it, how you're going to implement it. And so we talked about sort of the interviewing was step one. And then we've talked about sort of articulating, documenting the problem. And then sort of step three was sort of solutioning. Can you take me from there? So solutioning, and then like how you make it work in systems and how to enable it, and then how to reassess. So why don't we jump off from the solutioning step? Because I know I can't take all of your time as much as I would love to. This could be a 2-hour podcast like I recorded this morning. I'd happily do that, Jeff, but I think we agreed at the top that we weren't going to do that to each other.
We're not going to break the record.
We're not going for the record.
Yeah.
Let's do these three steps and then we'll call it. So talk to me about solutioning. Once you've found the sort of the problem, and instead of, hey, the solution that somebody's come to you with, you're able to articulate it, you've got buy-in from stakeholders, now what happens?
Yeah, it's this is an incredibly important part of the process, and one that can be potentially perceived by our stakeholders of slowing it down or why aren't you getting started, right? If we're going to use the capacity that we have to work on a specific roadmap item, which means we can't use it for something else, we better make sure that we're going to have something that works at the end of the day, something that is actually going to drive to those outcomes. So we need to be very thoughtful, just again, as you would in the product world, of doing that upfront solutioning, or product design or whatever you want to call it. At Sastre last year, our COO, Karen, made a statement, which I think is great, which is fall in love with the problem, not the solution, right? Mm-hmm. So at this point, we have fully identified what the problem is we need to be fixed, hopefully unbiased by how we can solution it. So now is the time to pull up from that and figure out how can we address this. So we're doing a number of things. We're going deeper if we need to on what, or making sure we fully understand and everyone who needs to work with the problem again, but that probably should have changed. But we're assessing what that ideal outcome should be. An ideal outcome is always in a number of things. It's to make life easier, provide a better experience, do things faster, do them cheaper, do things that increase any one of the dozens of sales KPIs that we think this could impact. So we really try to hone in on which one of those is really the one that we're addressing here when we fix this problem, so that we design a solution that can hit that. So we're coming up with basically the measures of success at this point. But what we have to be careful with is we can go on a never-ending journey and take a year to do something, but we still have to work in sales time, right? Deals need to get done. We have a number coming up next quarter, and then we're going to be planning for next year soon. Is to the extent possible, I prefer to break these out into phases and chunk them out so that we're constantly getting incremental value. And in some cases, non-incremental value by phasing it in is if we get something out in 2 weeks or 30 days that improves us in the right direction, but keeps us on that line towards that overall ideal solution whenever we get there, then that's the way that I want to approach this. So I always ask the team to think about what that first thing is. We tend to call these things cupcakes here, but I don't really like that term anymore because sometimes you forget to make the cake. But what is the low-hanging fruit? What are the things that we can do relatively easily? What are the things we can do with our own skill set without having to go work with partners? What are the things we do that are just going to take in the field that we don't need to do weeks of training and adoption that we can start hitting? So very much I want to break that up into, and if you think of like an agile process, which I'm not the expert on, but these are, you know, the stories or the epics or those sort of things that are the individual kind of tasks, or well, I think they're epics that go against the stories, right? That might be the other way around, but you get the idea. These are individual discrete tasks where there's a beginning and an end, which provides an outcome that the collective whole of those delivers the solution. So I asked them to kind of figure out how to phase those in and then to size the effort for each one of those. When can we get them done? Who needs to be involved to get them done? Do we have to work with anyone else to get them done? And I like to do that on a whiteboard, on a blank sheet of paper, and not constrained by how we do it now. That's certainly a consideration, but let's just think about if we can do whatever we need it to do and want it to do, what would that look like? And that's typically BSAs or working with our stakeholders to kind of do the traditional re-engineering, you know, process workflow. We will take some designs and even mock some of them up and put them back in front of people. Does this look like what you're asking for? Does this look like it's going to solve the problem? So there's still that iterative process. When we've kind of aligned on what those project tasks are, what order we want to do them in, and what we think we want to get to when we actually build and develop, then it's kind of going to our more technical folks and having them do the assessment of the change they need to deliver in the system. So they're going to come back with those plans. They're going to come back with the investigations that maybe need to be done. Oops, if we do this, what are we going to break? And how do we make sure that we don't break that? And they're going to come back with that sort of sizing. So that first part of it isn't the time commitment. That first part is what we're going to do in these phases to get specific outcomes that we can go deliver to the field and they can improve their experience. The second part of that is then really what does it take to do these things? And then we may come back to our stakeholders and say, of the five things that we thought of, the first two we can get done this quarter. You know, when you pull that thing on the roadmap, it's this big bucket of stuff that can get done. And it doesn't always work that way, you know, in reality. And typically it's like, yeah, we get why you can only do those two and that would be great to have it. And then we talk about whether that should go on the next time. The solutioning, I've kind of stepped out of a lot, you know, recently, and I've allowed the folks on my team to do this with whatever ways and methodologies they want to do. But it has to start with, are we solving the problem that caused us to put this on the roadmap in the first place? Are we breaking it up into chunks so we don't have to wait forever to get some value? Are we thinking about how to do this in the most efficient way for us, but also in the most least impactful way for when we roll out to the field? Like, if we don't need to change something as part of this to get the objectives, let's not, because then we have to manage that change. And have we thought about all of the resources and the capacity and constraints and the potential roadblocks for us to be successful? And if they are, let's figure them out now and let's figure out how to mitigate them or to work around them. And then it goes into the typical, either one of two ways. One, it can go into a typical kind of waterfall project planning approach if it's a longer and a bigger one, that sort of methodology, or it can just get put on a bunch of sprints that the systems team does, and they do 2-week sprints. You know, it could be a series of those things getting it done where you don't need the big program office and waterfall sort of methodology to get these done. I know I'm jumping ahead a bit, but, you know, when we finish these things out, I very much want us to celebrate them. And I said that a couple of times, you know, I want it to be just as cool that we finished some of these things in the roadmap and delivered value that we just closed a really cool logo, right? So I always want people to think about how we can articulate, not in the words we use as systems folks, operational folks, but in the words and the language that our stakeholders know and understand, for them to really go, wow, that is going to be really cool, really impactful, and do these great things for me.
That's awesome. And so really what I'm hearing is the solutioning, you're looking for that sort of, what's the lightest weight version one? And then next step.
I would agree. The lightest weight, but I really want to optimize around, does that lightweight thing actually make meaningful change that people will recognize?
Okay, good. Yeah. I think the idea that exists in my head comes from sort of the lean startup methodology, which is like, what's that minimum viable product? What is the first version, even if it's ugly and janky, that actually solves the problem?
And well, 100%. Yeah.
Okay. So what's our MVP? And then your next step is, how do we make it work within the systems that already exist? So if we want to build, you know, I don't know, a new dashboard, or if we want to change this, how do we make sure that it integrates? And so it's, you know, if something's added here, it's still piping into Hoopla, it's still getting put into Slack, it's putting into all those pieces.
Yeah, and I think a big part of that is what can we break, or what is going to break if we do this? Yeah. So let's anticipate those things before we do this, and make sure that we have a plan of either we have to backfill or rebuild some things or change some mappings, or communicate what's going on. I think that's a very, very important part of this, because we are operating on a live patient. You know, I kind of don't want to go changing the engine when the plane is flying. That's been used a million times, but our business still needs to run and we cannot disrupt it, which means we have to be very careful of when we put it live, or things that we move around or change are done in a way where it's, you know, a really seamless, hopefully seamless cut over.
Gotcha. Okay. So seamless cut over. And then I'm curious, because it's not just about the technical side of things. There's a process and a human side. So how do you, once you've got something new, how do you enable and train the team on it?
Yeah, good question. I think that's the part that is probably mostly neglected. And I think in many times I've been guilty of that as well. You know, just take a small, Just take a small example of maybe we just changed a couple names around in fields in CRM or the behavior of a couple of things that people just have imprinted, you know, on their daily routine, if they're just going to happen this way. You know, I get annoyed when I use some product and also the UI changes and I'm like, where's that button that I love? We tend to overlook how disruptive or impactful that may be on folks that don't live this like we do. So you always have to think about the comms. And you could manage the change by doing nothing more than just communicating what's happening, right? It might not be such a big, profound one. I think the comms and part of the roadmap process helps us with this is telling people what we're going to do before we do it. Telling people what's happening when it's going to happen on that day as the reminder. Reaching out and giving them a mechanism after in case they need any help or in case there's any problems. And that can be in the form of a Slack channel, which I don't think is the greatest thing, but that can just be in a form of, we're going to hold office hours on these times in these offices these days, where you know we're going to be available to help you fix things that might have been impacted by this. Or it actually just involves being like a sales manager and walking on the floor, you know, hey, how'd this work out for you? You know, can you show me how this is working? Any concerns, any things you want to share with us? So I think no matter how big or small, you have to communicate to your stakeholders what's changing and what's going to happen, and also the why. You know, there's I think many situations when you might communicate these things in the very technical sense, but you're failing to tell them how it's going to improve their lives and their daily experience. And we have to make sure that we sell it to them as well. Now, on the really big problems, I think you do need to put together a formal comms plan and a formal training and enablement plan. And training and enablement is not just, here's a meeting, it's mandatory, show up, we're going to talk to you for an hour, and now everything is good. A training plan, I think, involves the comms plan of before it's coming, when it's coming. It involves not just the how to do this in the new environment, it involves the why we're doing this and the benefit you should expect to receive. It involves mechanisms of, after we get this live, we're going to assess whether it is working the way you want it on this date. We're going to give you this outlet and this avenue of which to provide us feedback. We're going to pull some of you into the room, and we're looking for volunteers to kind of articulate to us what the experience was and what worked well and what didn't go well. So it's an enablement adoption plan. The documentation needs to be solid. Documentation, again, isn't just a PowerPoint slide that you give to people for an hour. It's whatever you use, Guru cards, your intranet, whatever spaces you have, of making sure all that's updated. It's making sure you get it into onboarding, right? So no new folks know what's coming. It's make sure you get into the hands of everybody that might be training or retraining folks when they go to new roles or have to do new things. But most importantly, it gets back to the stakeholder management. I love to get a small group of folks, ICs, sales reps, account managers, SDRs, involved in the final implementation and go live. I want them to play around with it in the sandbox before we flip the switch. I want them to get excited about what it can do. I want them to be able to say, this is a little awkward, or where did this thing go? Because we might not have realized we need to tell people where this thing went in our comms unless we heard it from some of them. So if you can get their hands on it, you can get their feedback, you can fix and address a number of the challenges that may be out there, whether it's confusion or complexity or just doesn't work the way we want it to work before you actually go live. But then you have other people besides you, besides ops, who are advocates for this, right? Mm. They're telling their buddies, they're telling their team, they're telling them that this thing is coming and I was part of actually helping to deploy it. And let me tell you how cool it is. So get some advocates. Don't just be one way from ops to like, here's all the change we're pushing. Get allies. Get people on the team who are actually doing this to help with that socialization. I also think that enablement is better done in smaller teams and face-to-face. I think it's ridiculous to think that we can run an enablement session here in San Francisco and have people in Chicago and Sydney and Dublin sit in there for an hour and kind of get all of the context of what's going on and get all of their questions and concerns answered. You know, you tend to speak to who's in the room. Mm-hmm. And maybe you do it globally to begin with, but then I think you need to do some tours potentially, or you need to offer, we can join your team meetings for 10 minutes to answer any questions, or old office hours. In other words, I think that what I'm getting to is that it's a journey to get adoption enablement, not a one-time thing. And you should schedule and plan that out before you release these things. Have a refresher in a month, have another one in 6 months. Constantly poll the team of how it's working and whether they're using it in order to make sure it's adopted.
That's amazing. And I, in keeping to my promise to keep you here, I got one last question for you. And you sort of hinted on it earlier. And so I want to pull on that thread a little bit. But you said something about 6 months and you're checking back in 6 months. So what is that process? Yeah. I've gone through, you know, everything from, you know, all the interviews, you've documented the problem, you've done the solutioning, sort of figured out how to make it work in the systems. You've enabled it, you've trained people. 6 months later, what happens?
Yeah. Great question and a really tough one to answer. The reality is all these things that I've articulated are very aspirational. I would love to do them all and perfectly every time. And I don't think it ever quite happens for a number of reasons. I think the one that you just asked is the hardest one because you moved on, right?
Yeah.
And I actually don't want to use the name of the solution, but there was a solution I bought pretty soon after I joined that solved a big problem. We stood it up and people use it and they loved it. And literally like 9 months later, I'm like, why isn't this happening? And like, nobody was using it anymore. And I just didn't know that. And nobody actually knew why. And I think it was conflicting with something else in there. So there was a reason for me to kind of ask, but otherwise I might not have ever known, right? And that reminded me of the importance of, I think, going back and reassessing. I think that the reassessment has to start at the grassroots level. It has to start with the people that are actually using this. And I think that you can do it in a number of ways. So like in my brain, like the most formal, best way of doing this, which I don't do, would just be to have in the project plan with the reminders, a standard kind of survey, a research survey that first goes out to everybody that just asks a bunch of leading questions of, are you using it? Are you not using it? If you're not using it, why? Is it solving this problem? Is it solving that problem? What are the things that you think could have been better? Did you learn how to use this if you're new? What are ways that you'd like, if we just put one of those together and just, you know, something, you know, bop this on the side of the head 6 months after we delivered something of send this out, I think that would give us enough insights to know, hey, it's really working, so we're all good. We don't necessarily need to do anything, or maybe we've got some problems, so now we should start meeting with folks either individually at the team level and really digging in and assessing why. I think very importantly, you have to do that with an open mind. Maybe the things that we were solving are not a problem anymore because of other change or other things that have been happening in the organization. And that's perfectly okay. You don't need to live and continue with things forever, right? Maybe we did solve it in the right way. You know, nobody's fault necessarily, but maybe we just didn't come up with the right and the best solution. So we need to pull back and rethink this. Maybe there's just a couple little adjustments that we can make that would make it work and make it take. Maybe it was consumed by something else we did, so now it's not as relevant anymore. And I think that when we go through that, it should be an open mind, not of like, why aren't they using this thing we spent all this time on? Of, let's just figure out what the truth is and figure out whether we need to continue with this, make major changes, or just make a couple of corrections. I think it's really, really important. I think it also reminds, even if it's working well, I think it reminds the folks that are using it that it's there and it's a little bit of a refresh for them as well, of maybe I should think about how I'm using this. Maybe I should use it more in my daily routine. Maybe I should ask some of the questions that I never asked. Maybe I should reinvigorate, you know, the things that I was doing that I remember were so great that I just kind of stopped doing. Again, I don't think there's, the most difficult part of that is actually doing it. I think the how you do it can vary. And I think it's probably the thing that we tend to do least often.
That's fair. And I wonder if it's almost a bit of the system of, you know, the people that you're servicing, they know that you have this process, so they don't want to come back to you with these little tweaks and little tunes. I mean, in buildings, in the process of building software, and not that I built lots, but I've helped build some, it's amazing how sometimes the being off by just a degree or two,
yeah, means
everything is not useless, but just doesn't get used. And how sometimes we just miss those really quick wins, that if you were to go back and have that conversation, sometimes you can find, oh, you know, it's an education problem, or it's, oh, you know what, we made this in the wrong spot, or we forgot to add this. And there's very easy to solve problems that sometimes people just make assumptions about, oh, maybe they just designed it this way because they hate me.
Yeah, 100%. It could be a 5 minutes fix, which is the difference of like full adoption and people loving it versus not. And I think, you know, kind of circling back to the beginning is, I like being on a sales team. I want everyone that works for me to feel part of the sales team. And I constantly encourage them in the context of a project or not to get out there, to shadow people, to go through some of the onboarding again themselves, to take over the reins of a couple of these things and try it, you know, hello to a lead that's coming through our messenger on the web and, you know, get to see that experience and create an opportunity themselves. I think the more that we can constantly just shadow, observe, not for any other purpose than shadowing and observing, I think that we will start to do better to see how these things are really impacting the field and those little things that we can fix that to us might seem so little, but can be so big, you know, to the field if we just put them up there, maybe not glamorous or sexy, but, you know, a day of work, a week of work, just can, you know, go from here to here in terms of the experience for folks. I think it's really, really important to stay close to the people that we work with.
That's such a great piece of advice. And I think a really good spot to leave it, because I could just keep asking you questions all day and all day and really go for that record, but I did make a promise and I do want to keep that. Jeff, one last question. If people want to get in touch with you, if they have questions, if they need a little bit of help, or they just want to say thanks for such a great episode, what's the best way they can find you?
You know, LinkedIn, I think, is the best medium for that. You know, Jeffrey Serlin, Serlin, they will be able to find me there. And the mugshot generally looks like it does now on the screen. So yeah, more than happy to reach back out to folks. And, you know, I'm always in the market for learning new ideas and better ways of doing things too. I think that the best part of being an ops is it's constant discovery. And I think that makes my job fun. And I know that no matter how often I do things and how long we do things, that there's always people who have figured out more elegant ways, faster ways, cooler ways than we have. And so sharing those kind of stories, those battles, the things that we did, I think is always a great thing to do.
That's great. I couldn't agree more. The number of things as a salesperson that I've learned from product management, the product management discipline or building software, it's been phenomenal. So couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
Thanks again, Jeff, for coming on the show. This has been great.
Thank you, Tom.